Constructivist avocado toast. That's the new...
Constructivist avocado toast!
That's our new alt-rock band name.
This is how we deal with North Korea.
Idea bombs. Welcome to Arbitration, a podcast where we make international relations theory relevant to current events. In this episode, we are discussing balance of risk theory and the potentially brewing trade war with China, all due to Kim Jong-un. I'm your host, Drake McFarlane, and creative director of Arbiter. I'm here today with Sophia Freuden and Hannah Lesiter. Care to introduce yourselves?
Hi, friends. I'm Sophia Freuden, the editor-in-chief of Arbiter and a regular here on Arbitration.
I'm Hannah Lesiter. I'm the director of networking at Arbiter and also a regular, it seems.
Yep. So, folks, today we're talking about balance of risk theory. It sounds a little bit like a financial report, but trust me, it's a little bit more fun. It's a theory put forth by Jeffrey W. Taliaferro of Tufts University, and it's an offshoot of defensive realism. As we've discussed in previous episodes, realism is one of the three main paradigms of international relations theory. It's the paradigm that you get to wear, you know, leather jackets, talk about Nietzsche, and basically hate life. The best part, though, is defensive realism is a bit more, well, realistic one. It incorporates game theoretical models, rationalism, and the rest to try and explain why states want to kill each other. And balance of risk theory builds off of economic theory. I know, it never stops. Specifically, it's built off of prospect theory. It's this idea that folks make decisions based on the potential value of a gain or loss rather than the actual final outcome. So think of it this way. People are deciding whether or not to have a coffee or water, not based on the actual quality of said water or said coffee, but on the theoretical gain of the coffee they could get. Mm-hmm. Sounds a little bit weird, but we'll dig into it a bit more.
I mean, caffeine, though, is really necessary and beneficial.
Yes, but hydration is also...
Sophia, you just sound like you haven't had your morning coffee.
I actually don't drink coffee, because if I do, I get serious cases of jitters and turn into the most insane person you've ever met.
Well, I have basically caffeine-induced delirium tremens if I don't have like a quad shot in the morning of caffeine, so here we go. Yeah, I know. So, anyway, now what makes this important for international relations theory is that this guy, Taliaferro, decided to apply prospect theory about risk and how people judge values and gains, and then try to make, to understand why states sometimes do incredibly risky maneuvers when we usually assume states are mostly rational and don't like huge risks. And specifically in his original paper on the subject, he was trying to explain why in Vietnam, the U.S. kept pushing further, even though we were, well, losing the battle. We'd already lost many American lives. It was costly politically and in terms of blood and treasure. Why keep going?
Not to mention the virulent anti-war effort that creeped up for the Vietnam War, which was like the first true anti-war movement that the U.S. had ever seen, exactly. Really. So
yeah, flower power was a thing.
It was a thing. I mean, tell me about the Twilight Struggle, Drake.
Yeah, I know, right? It's a Twilight Struggle between the USSR and the U.S. and the flower power people are just taking down America.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about this is that he said, essentially, people have frames by which they look at a problem. So, you either have a gains frame or a losses frame.
If I may interject, I'd just like to remind the audience that in international affairs theory studies, we assume that actors are rational.
Which, just like economics, is a problematic assumption.
Yes, but we do it anyway.
Yeah, and in a basic tenet of game theory, which is a portion of rationalism, is that you have to assume the other actor is informed and rational to make rational decisions. It's hard to make good strategy against somebody you think is crazy. They may be crazy, but you still have to act as if they aren't.
Yeah. Which is why the unpredictability of leaders of late is interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And this is maybe a controversial opinion. I personally don't think that Kim Jong-un is an irrational actor.
Oh, we'll dig into that shortly, actually. So, essentially, let's assume people either in a gains or a losses framework. If they're in a gains framework, the idea is that you're in a situation where you've already won something, you're okay.
You right? won a couple battles, you won a couple hands at, you know, blackjack, right. Whatever it is.
Now, say there's an opportunity that comes up, and it might be a bit risky, but you'll get a huge payoff. if you do it. If you're in a games framework, you're actually less likely to take that risk because you're doing well. That's not to say you won't continue to take risks, mm-hmm. but it's not as probable. Now, say you're at the casino, you're down a lot of hands. It looks like you bet the orphanage on the horse race, that sort of thing. You're losing. Now, we think somebody's losing a lot, they'll, you know, take their chips and go home. But actually, they find that if there's a risky proposition that has a huge payoff, they're more likely to go pick it, to try and recoup their losses. Mm-hmm. So essentially, it means that if you're in a losses framework, you are risk acceptant. Well, if you're in a games framework, you're either risk averse or risk neutral, at the very least in comparison to something else. Mm-hmm. So the thing is that you tend to make better decisions when you're in a games framework. It's essentially the equivalent is if you have a roof over your head and food and water and whatever, it's easier to make daily decisions. But if you're out in the wilderness, risk starts to take a bigger hold.
Desperate people do desperate things.
Exactly.
Because the benefit is more important at that point.
Exactly.
It's more about survival than it is about further success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what makes balance of risk theory really useful is that it tries to explain why leaders double down in terrible situations. So like Vietnam, why we kept on pushing, Operation Rolling Thunder, what have you, even though the rational thing might have been to cut our losses, go home. And we're not talking about domino theory here. That's a separate thing. But it's the same thing like, George W. Bush saying, hey, gotta go in Iraq. There's a couple thousand Americans are dead.
Or Afghanistan, yeah. Right? Like how we are. It's the world's, not the world's, but the U.S.'s longest going conflict, mm-hmm. longer than Vietnam even at this point in time.
Yeah.
And obviously our losses in Afghanistan have not been anywhere near that of Vietnam, but it still begs the question of why are we there?
Exactly.
Well, we're not talking about Afghanistan today.
Right. But the basic idea is it's this theory is best illustrated by their deaths shall not be in vain. Because it doesn't matter whether it's in vain from a rational standpoint.
A dead person is a dead person is a dead person, no matter why or how they died.
Exactly. We're continuing our trend of being depressing, but the basic idea is that...
Depressing, we're just cold.
Right. Is that essentially a dead person or lost money is a sunk cost. An irrational person has to say, I'm never going to get that cost back. Let's just keep moving forward. But instead what you find is that most people, when they're in a losses framework, said they lost loved ones, they lost money, whatever, they're going to take a more risky option to recoup said losses. So maybe revenge or send a surge of troops in after we've lost a couple already. Or to go into an unrelated country to go fight some terrorists vaguely mm-hmm. and spend billions of dollars doing so. Mm-hmm. And that might be well and fine from a political standpoint, but from a theoretical one, it helps us understand why things that seem a little bit crazy on paper happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the basics of balance of risk theory. It's strong because it's rational. It explains the seemingly irrational behavior. And it's also buoyed by economic research and psychological studies about how people operate. However, there are some weaknesses. Any of you want to take care of that one?
So it's a first image theory, meaning it's at the individual level of analysis. So when we talk about this theory, we tend to think of it in terms of, all right, in this situation, Kim Jong-un or Xi Jinping or Donald Trump, you know, what are they thinking about in terms of their gains or their losses? Are they in a winning frame of mind, or are they kind of looking at the bad hands that they played and go, I'm saying to themselves, oh geez, like, this sucks.
Oh geez, this sucks, yeah. Except on a scale where there's nuclear weapons
on the table, yeah, and that's really frightening. And the whole nuclear weapons thing brings in a different kind of game theory that we're not going to talk about really in detail today. Because we're specifically trying to focus on the trade war triangle sort of between the U.S. Right. and North Korea and China. But,
Another one of the weaknesses, which we sort of brought up earlier, is that it assumes rationality. And that's a little bit problematic because, I mean, generally, you can't just assume that someone is rational.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a game of chicken on the road.
Yeah.
Like, you can't... likely can assume that the person that you're playing chicken with is rational and doesn't want to die and will therefore, you know, turn the car, but not necessarily true. That's why it's called chicken. That's
right.
A dangerous game.
And before some of my economics or certain psychology people tell me, well, technically rationality is assumed even in emotional and difficult actors. Yes, but that's a more complicated behavioral economics model. We're talking rationality in a colloquial sense. The idea that people are not going to do something crazy.
Mm-hmm. Because regardless of whether they're like a stable person, everyone has interests.
Exactly.
And at the state level, interests rule all.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, a actor will be rational so that they will achieve their interests. Right. Yeah.
And that's hoping that that works. But and so essentially to help explain a crazy actor or a really risky one, we
or
would just...
Or a seemingly crazy actor.
Unpredictable actor.
We just have to realize they have interests. Those interests may seem crazy. Maybe they believe there's an alien speaking to them and they have to go, you know, go to war with Russia. Fine. That may be crazy to us, but within their own mindset, that is a rational thing for them to do. Mm-hmm. And so there's the rationality thing taken care of. Now, trying to connect this bizarre 1980s-esque theory plus some game theory and some economics behind it to international affairs, that's where it gets tricky, but it's actually kind of special. So here's the event. Trump threatened North Korea. Yeah, I know, fire and fury. But specifically, he threatened them, or rather, threatened China with ceasing trade if they didn't deal with North Korea. To be precise, he tweeted on Sunday, September 3rd, quote, "The United States is considering, in addition to other options, stopping all trade with any country doing business with North Korea," end quote. That's tilted towards China. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, why in the world would we say something that crazy? Well, that's where balance of risk theory comes in. Any of y'all want to take point?
If we're going from the theory here, we could assume that he is in a losses framework.
Right.
And is risk acceptant.
Exactly. Yeah.
The problem with this particular gamble or bet is that, A, it likely is a bluff, right? It's likely just something that he's saying because we all know that Donald is full of hot air and not much else. There's that. Another problem with this particular threat is that trade wars are notoriously just terrible for all those involved. It's not really a war you can win, not in the 21st century, with the level of interconnectedness that we have between our economies and our financial systems.
And as an additional thing, embargoes and boycotts aren't really that effective from an empirical standpoint. People like doing them, but they don't usually have an effect on, say, another actor or a market. If you're interested about that, there's actually a great Freakonomics episode from this past week talking about that. So, okay.
We are not in any way sponsored by Freakonomics.
No, they're
just cool. Clear that up.
They're just cool.
We're just a bunch of fanboys and fangirls.
Right. But let's talk about how nuts this is.
For ha.
A
ha.
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 Ha. Ha.
All right. That was a nuclear utilization theories pun that I don't think Drake intended, but I found particularly funny.
Yeah. If you want to hear more crazy game theory about nuclear weapons, Nuts Theory is really fun. It's by this guy named Herman Kahn. It's the alternative to mutually assured destruction. It's the idea that, hey, maybe we can nuke each other and the world won't end. But anyway.
We've talked about it in several episodes, I think, at this point.
What matters is this crazy, crazy threat he made. Well, let's look at what North Korea's trade policies actually are and who they work with. Technically, North Korea actually trades with about 100 countries, which include Russia, India, and principally China. And, of course, if somehow Trump said, okay, we're going to cease all trade with all those countries, or at the very least, China, well, according to NBC News, quote, "Americans would likely feel these effects as acutely as anyone," end quote. Now, it turns out that China is one of America's largest trading partners. In fact, the total goods and services trade between the two nations totaled to an estimated $648.2 billion last year. And according to the Department of Commerce, exports to China alone support an estimated 911,000 U.S. jobs.
I want Trump to somehow, you know, claim that he's, you know, going to bring back jobs or what have you and then start this trade war
right.
with China.
So, in short, it's not going to happen, a trade embargo. But anything that might depress trade between North Korea and China is a big deal. The North's biggest trading partner is China. Crazy, I know. And it accounts for 4/5 of its trade and helps its country with fuel, food, guns, steel, etc. So without China, North Korea is basically adrift.
SOL.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing that I'd like to interject about this whole thing is that while China is obviously very, very important to North Korea, a lot of people, including Donald Trump, are leaning heavily on China to do something about North Korea. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we might be overestimating the amount of control that China has over North Korea, and also just how willing it's
how willing China is to get his hands dirty in all of this.
And I mean, it's also, we have to take in consideration that North Korea and China share a border.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the last thing they want are migrants, you know, in the event of a conventional warfare or what have you, the last thing they want are millions of North Korean refugees pouring into China because of bombing and shelling or whatever.
Well, and this is where it also gets interesting, is that China's current president, Xi Jinping, he's not up for elections shortly, but his big party conference is coming up very soon. And he's positioned himself as the new strongman of China, for lack of a better term. The North Korean threat distracts from his main agenda, and it depresses his political power.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting, and how we can apply this theory to this, is that he's probably going to be more risk acceptant. That means he can deal with North Korea soon. So this is where it gets scary. You have a situation where we have a rogue actor, North Korea, lighting off some very large bottle rockets. We have the United States, who has usually taken the stance of ignore North Korea and just make sure it doesn't blow up.
Sanction and ignore.
Right, exactly. China, the same thing. But now, because of the new nuclear threat, and America has a leader who's had a series of losses, whether it be healthcare, credibility reasons, or what have you.
Poll numbers.
Yeah. And then you have China, which is about to face a political issue if North Korea implodes on itself. We are in a situation where riskier behavior is predicted. Now, what that behavior may be is a firm question. But just an illustration that people are bandying about the idea of a trade war with China in this economy sounds like insanity.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, most people dismiss Trump as being, oh, he's just making a bluff or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's not just a bluff. He may not do it, but it reflects the standpoint and attitude.
Yeah.
The White House is super risk acceptant right now because they've been dealt, well, not dealt bad hands, but they've been playing some bad hands.
Yeah, they've been playing, they were actually, the Republican Party was dealt the best possible hand you could have.
And they've squandered it.
Seriously. No major legislation passed to this day.
Mm-mm.
It's incredible. And not only that, but Donald Trump just signed a budget deal with the Democrats. That was mind-blowing. It was only for 3 months to extend, you know, the budget for 3 months so we don't hit the debt ceiling. It also included some funding for disaster relief for Harvey and Hurricane Harvey and other natural disasters and wildfires that have been rampaging the U.S. But it's just, at home and abroad, the administration, the entire Republican Party has just been suffering loss after loss after loss, despite this fantastic hand that they've been given. Right.
It's astronomically rare for a party to control all branches of government. Judicial branch, what have you, the executive and Congress, and the legislative branch, if you will.
Yeah.
Yet they're not able to do much with it. That's problematic. And that's probably subject of many different episodes if you really wanted to know about how that works and why it's so problematic. I mean, if you have a complete majority in control and you're not able to push policies, well, that tells you there's a problem with the party itself. But that's neither here nor there when it comes to international policy at the moment. What matters is that we have controlling parties that are highly risk acceptant and ready to do anything if that means they can get a win.
So last week we talked about the diversionary theory of war.
Uh-huh.
And whether or not North Korea could be a diversion. This seems to relate to this, the losses and the risk acceptance. How does that fit in here?
Well, if anything, diversionary theory of war would be a risky move that could be taken by somebody who is risk acceptant.
This is a legitimate political issue,
right?
Like, regardless of whatever diversion you want to spin onto it, but it's just a matter of, you know, what the president says when, what he says on Twitter, how he says it, that kind of thing that makes it a true diversion.
Mm-hmm.
Or if he's willing to, you know, take exceptionally risky behavior, i.e. military, you know, use of military force, which has not been done in North Korea since the Korean War. That would be a hell of a diversion and also fitting in with those theories. These two theories are not incompatible, right?
No, they seem to be pretty compatible.
Yeah, in this particular instance, sometimes they are incompatible, right?
Right.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's, to say the least, risky behavior is problematic, and it's reflected not just in government, but also in the markets. So if we look at the markets recently, there's an index called the CBOE Volatility Index, or VIX. And of course, for those who are not aware, volatility index is essentially a reflection of how volatile the political and economic system is. Now, finance people out there is probably yelling at me that that's a gross oversimplification, but it's a nice little illustration, essentially. And it's always fun to see when this when the VIX explodes, essentially. For instance, its highest point in the past year was right before the election, right? And it's only coincidental, one might say, that in this past week, or really even over the past month, of North Korean tensions and risky behavior, VIX has been up. And people have been making a lot of money if you've been betting that, of course, the world's going to end. So my money is that Kim Jong-un just has a lot of stock in VIX, but we'll find out.
My theory is that he really wants the U.S. to leave him alone. And another, well, he really wants the U.S. to leave him alone. He's consolidated a lot of power within his regime. And he understands the basic concept that if you have a nuclear weapon, people will leave you alone. So that's why I think, you know, Kim Jong-un ultimately is a rational actor, despite the fact that he has weird ideas about just stuff in general and a strange obsession with Dennis Rodman. He wants what he wants. He wants what he has. He wants power. He wants control.
And let's not forget that the last couple dictators to not have a nuclear weapon are in the grave. So if you are a tin pot dictator like Kim Jong-un, you're going to be looking at guys like, say, Gaddafi or Saddam. And you're wondering, what happened to these guys and not to me? Well, both of them did not have weapons of mass destruction. The moment you enter the nuclear club, people don't mess around with you. You're treated differently. That isn't good, but it is true. Gaddafi eliminated his nuclear program back in the early 2000s. You want to take a little bit more on that, Sophia?
Well, he probably looked at what was happening in the Middle East with the U.S. invasion, U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, and said, well, not worth it, you know?
Right. But the irony is that if he had a working missile, they'd be less likely to attack him.
But Libya with a functional nuclear weapons program, that's like the most entertaining thing I've ever
No, but done. The thing is if you're a dictator, you're thinking, okay, if there's one thing that's going to stop America from invading me, is having a nuclear weapon. But the one thing that's going to get them to invade me is the moments when I don't have a nuclear weapon, or I'm building one. So that's the irony.
North Korea is just not in the club right now.
Right.
And it is in their interest to obtain nuclear weapons so that they can be in the club, so that they can have the legitimacy.
It's worth mentioning that North Korea has nuclear weapons. It's just unsure of how capable they are of getting those nuclear weapons anywhere farther than, let's say, South Korea or Japan.
Right.
And so these most recent missile launches have been, you know, pretty impressive in terms of the distance that they can cover.
Right.
They're on the verge of breaking into a full-on ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile, and that's pretty scary. Once you hit ICBM status with your missile capabilities, you're 100% in the nuclear club.
So, just to clear that up, we haven't reached mutually assured destruction quite
it's
yet.
It's unknown. Most likely not.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, they'll never have enough nuclear weapons to have MAD between, say, U.S., in North Korea.
Or Russia.
Or anything. But North Korea is thinking like a weaker power during the Cold War. So let's take France, for instance. France during the Cold War did not have the same amount of nuclear weapons as the U.S. or whatever, but they had enough to make the USSR worried, and they were on the side that also had enough nukes. The idea being that if Paris is hit, maybe America will come in and hit Moscow. Mm-hmm. Of course, Charles de Gaulle didn't believe that we'd trade Pittsburgh for Paris. But that's the basic idea, mm-hmm. is that even if you're a weaker power, as long as you have Big Brother next to you, mm-hmm. who also has nuclear weapons, and you too have nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. then you're part of the, you know, the nuclear club that'll fight the other nuclear club.
Yeah. Here's a question. What do you two think China, or like, how do you think China feels about North Korea developing better and better missile capabilities?
I think it'd probably scare the hell out of them.
Risk adverse.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to poke the bear.
Right. And that's something we should talk about there for a sec. Although maybe Mr. Xi is a bit risk acceptant going into, say, a political arena when he's in a personal losses framework. But China as a country is a rising power.
Mm-hmm.
It is in a gains framework, I would argue. Hence their risk aversion. They are not going to want North Korea, you know, tossing missiles everywhere. And they also don't want a united Korea on their border either.
Their ideal, China's ideal, and this is really what informs their entire hesitance to get their hands messy, as I said earlier, China's not doing anything because China is perfectly happy with the status quo. The status quo is the best case scenario for China because it means that U.S. troops aren't stationed on the North Korean border because if North Korea and South Korea were to unite, U.S. troops would therefore be on the Chinese border. A, and B, it keeps a hostile and somewhat intimidating state, you know, under their control that they can use as sort of a geopolitical weapon internationally. So they want North Korea around. They don't want those migrants pouring in. They don't want American troops on their border. This is the best possible situation for them. But it's also coming to the point, as I mentioned earlier, that they might not be able to control that irrational state that they like using as a geopolitical weapon and may at some point in time determine, hey, if you're going to act like a stupid 12-year-old with nuclear weapons, then I'm not going to let you do this. So.
But I'm not going to let you do this. What does that entail? Does that mean they just cut off the power? Or does that mean they off Kim Jong-un? Well, what are we talking about?
Cutting off power and food would really...
Well, it would be what Trump wants. Trade.
Right.
Shut down trade.
But there's the risk, and this is where we can, you know, talk ourselves in circles forever. What if you cut off the food and water to pressure North Korea to stop making nuclear weapons or chill out a little bit? Instead, they go, oh, you're going to cut it off? Then I'll hurt you.
Conditionality.
And so, you know, maybe there's strings attached to whatever deal that'll happen. But the scary thing is, and which makes North Korea a power in its own right that can punch far above its weight, is that because it's quote-unquote crazy enough, or rather, it has nothing to lose, besides maybe, you know, Kim Jong-un's head, then they're more prepared to fight dirty, to, you know, light off a firecracker, whenever the big, you know, the adults in the international room try to tell them to cut it out. And to be frank, I don't know how we're going to untie this Gordian knot that is North Korea. It's been there for 70 years, and the status quo has been happy for both sides of the political aisle. But now that they have just enough technology, it's amazing. Over 70 years, they're finally in 1955. They still, you know, we can no longer just still wait. But what are our policy options? We can't just blow them up.
I heard something interesting on NPR yesterday. And it was that they seem, out of the people that do leave North Korea now, many of them are millennials in their 20-somethings.
Millennials killing him. What will millennials kill next?
And the theory
millennials
was,
are killing North Korea, guys.
The idea was that the millennial generation of North Korea may not be as brainwashed as the older generations.
Wait a minute. Someone hold the phone. The millennials distrust their elders? Where have I heard this story again and again and again?
So are you saying that we need to, like, airdrop avocado toast into North Korea and that'll change everything?
As long as the avocado toast also contains, like, ideas including...
Constructivist avocado toast. That's the new...
Constructivist avocado toast!
That's our
toast.
New alt
This is how we deal with North Korea.
Right. Idea bombs. And for those who are just tuning in, constructivism is the hippy-dippy paradigm of international affairs that, much to the chagrin of all of the tough and austere realists...
John Mearsheimer wannabes.
Right. It's actually pretty relevant and explains a lot of behavior that aren't easily explained by, oh, the other guy had a bigger army, or, oh, we had more money. It's ideas that matter, and perhaps the thing that will cut the Gordian knot here isn't guns, isn't trade. It might be that, you know, they'll believe in freedom and want to change things on their own.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that'll be the one outcome, but it will help with the solution.
Absolutely, and I mean, knowledge is power. You know, ideas cannot be killed with nuclear weapons.
They can be deterred by a totalitarian government. But this isn't 1960 where you can totally shut off all information. It's inevitable that that information will get through the cracks of the North Korean firewall.
Right.
I just wonder how long it'll take.
And I mean, another thing that was mentioned on the NPR story that I listened to was that more North Koreans now than ever before have access to movies, even Hollywood movies, cell phones, and other personal technology. At risk, they possess these things, but more have them now than ever.
One of the largest viewerships of the show NCIS is North Korea.
That's hilarious. I mean, in the end, this reminds me a lot of the late Cold War period, where the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc was being whittled away, not necessarily through gunfire or nuclear storms, but no, by one Levi's jean jacket and pants and jeans in general at a time.
I've heard this story before. Happened in the Soviet Union, except it didn't end in a geopolitical disaster. It ended in the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rise of Vladimir Putin 10 years later. So that's another thing we have to be mindful of is, you know, let's say this all goes hunky-dory. No nuclear missiles are launched. Eventually, North Korea, as a result of Chinese actions, as a result of its own ineptitude, collapses or something.
Implodes. You know,
implodes. And the two Koreas are reunited. Whatever. We have to be really mindful of the fact that, you know, there's a lot of history there. There's a lot of history in that country that those people won't forget. And that kind of vacuum can lead for some really, you know, destable politics. That's not to say that the South Korean government won't be able to handle it, but trying to develop the entire northern half of their country, right? North Korea is so underdeveloped, it's insane.
Well, yeah, it's like, think about this. It was enough of a struggle trying to put Germany back together. And East Germany, although it was under an iron grip, it was nowhere on the level that North Korea is today. And there's just been more time that has passed. And I think a big portion of why nobody's tried to, you know, unite the countries or been all right with that is nobody wants to be left holding the bag, essentially. If China intervenes and takes out North Korean government, then they have to spend the money, time, what have you, on fixing it. If we go in there and turn the country to glass, then we have to put it back together. And then we have to spend time, money, energy, and lives trying to fix this blighted country. So the thing is, the status quo is the best option for the average citizen of the great powers, in that, okay, just let it be, and we can just ignore it. It'll be like the black mold in the kitchen. As long as you don't look at it, it probably won't kill you. But the moment you have to try and deal with it, then you have to get in, you know, you have to hire a consultant, you got to fumigate the house, turns out there's black mold everywhere. It's a mess that nobody wants to touch, but eventually you have to touch it.
Yeah. I think the best possible solution is to basically wait until Kim Jong-un ages and dies and then just hope and pray.
So wait another 50 years?
Yeah, hope and pray that whoever, you know, assumes power of North Korea is slightly less...
insane?
He's not insane, and I don't like using that language just because it's demonizes mental health issues, but it's he is very power hungry.
Well, to be honest, though, it's not just, to be honest, if you put somebody who's a smooth political operator in his shoes, they would probably do something very similar.
That's the most beneficial thing to them.
Right. I mean, you know, morality aside, right, a lot of the brutal things he's doing as a dictator is necessary to, you know, survive and maintain his power. It would be really nice if he were magnanimous and try to change the system from within. But I guarantee you, he doesn't have as much direct power as we think. There's a whole cabal of generals who would love to off him if he didn't do what they wanted, mm-hmm. and vice versa. This is not this isn't like a feudal kingdom where in the stories where everybody kind of gets along. This is Game of Thrones, but in North Korea. And it's far worse, it's far more opaque, and one wrong move will either lead to North Korea, you know, blowing somebody up, or Kim Jong-un's head rolling on the floor.
Off with the head!
Exactly. So
be careful what you say. You can get assassinated by the North Korean government, Hannah.
Wow. I'm sorry, North Korea. Please don't hurt me.
You've been banned from r/Pyongyang. Anyway, one way or another, the North Korean problem isn't going to be solved anytime soon without a lot of people dying and maybe a couple people losing their Senate seats. Or presidential seat.
Or their head.
Or their head. But let's hope that we can keep the loss of life to a minimum.
We could die, or worse, be expelled.
Oh, God. All right.
That's what it just sounds like to me.
All right, Hermione. Okay. Yeah.
So we're ending on a depressing note as usual, but let's just do a roundtable about what do you think is going to happen in the next couple weeks? Well, what I'm saying is this. Let's slaughter a goat, find the entrails, and try to find meaning in said entrails.
Could you be more graphic?
Is this a sacrifice?
It's a sort of a...
international affairs theory gods?
Yes.
Yeah. It's have mercy on us now?
We're tribal people trying to divine something from the stars or from the entrails of some slaughtered goat. is the metaphor I'm trying to go across. We don't know necessarily what's going to happen, but let's try and peer at the data that we have and try to divine what the future will be.
I think China is going to be facing a lot of pressure to use trade sanctions or what have you. And I think at some point they will give in because North Korea is one country and the rest of the world is a lot of countries that are, I mean, if everyone starts putting pressure on China, like seems to be occurring. There's a lot of pressure there. They will have to do something, and that something will have to be, if not completely cut off trade with North Korea. Bad idea, but they'll have to start making threats too, or something.
You know? What I would do is, if I was China and I, you know, was running up against this international wall, I would cause rolling blackouts throughout North Korea. Just cut off their coal supplies every now and again and just remind them, you know. That way you're not pissing them off so much that they're going to do something to you. And it's also, you know, provides space for good behavior and incentive for good behavior. Like, hey, I'm going to cause some blackouts in your country. I'll make them stop if you, you know, get your shit under control. But you get your stuff under control.
Right.
This huge power struggle.
I'm going to be inclined to agree with you two on this one. I don't think God Emperor Donald Trump is going to solve this one. And I also don't think we can just sit by and wait for Kim Jong-un to have a son and just continue the Kim line. What's most likely is China's going to do something about it. And we have to hope they do something right. And hope they'll be nice about it, or at least good towards our interests.
Yeah,
China, help.
China has invested so much money in the United States that it's in none of their interest to let us get hurt in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, congratulations.
Not only would it be a disaster in terms of just, like, nuclear war, sort of, you know, what is that Cold War movie? Endgame? Enders?
No. War Games.
Yeah, with, was it Matthew Broderick?
Not the Hunger Games.
That's the entire nation of North Korea is just basically the Hunger Games. Anyway,
but people eat grass. They have that. They don't have much food.
Well, let's not. It's so depressing.
Anyway,
what I was saying was War Games. Yeah, that 1980s movie with Matthew Broderick. Not only would that be problematic for China, but like let's say hypothetically, best case scenario, China takes out one major U.S. city and that's it. The nuclear conflict doesn't escalate from there, which is highly unlikely and basically impossible. If one city were to be just nuclear, like, annihilated, that would be terrible for the global economy. Right. Terrible for the U.S. economy, terrible for the Chinese economy, just bad. So that's liberalism for you. We're all interconnected. We're all friends, right?
Right. And so I think although we always have depressing topics, we can end this episode on a lighter note to know people have too much money and time invested to blow it all up. And in any case, this ends the latest installment of Arbitration. I would like to thank Sophia and Hannah for joining me today, as well as Steph Reeves, our fantastic editor. You can catch us on iTunes, Google Play, or Spreaker for more of our podcasts. Check out our website, arbiter.org, for more articles and shenanigans. We're also on Facebook and Twitter as @arbiter.org. We'll be back in a fortnight, folks.
Subscribe. Leave a review.
Remember, the constructivist avocado toast is how we will deal with North Korea.
Yeah.
See ya.